Camasta v. Joseph Banks, 13-2831. Mr. Oppenheim.
I am, Your Honor. May it please the Court, this case is up before you in the posture of an appeal of a grant of a 12B6 motion to dismiss our two-count cause of action, both of which are based on a deceptive practice for which Bank was already cited by and fined by the New York Attorney General. We allege that it's the same conduct that just continued because, as with many things, the profit from wrongful conduct exceeded in monetary value the fine. In this case, we tried to act as private attorneys general, and we were essentially cut off at the pass. With respect to our first cause of action, the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act, what the court held first was that we had an obligation to plead it under the heightened Rule 9b standard, which we then did in an amended complaint, specifically attending to the actual damages requirement that this court set out in Kim versus Carter's. There are specific allegations in the complaint, both that the practice of the ongoing and falsely time-limited sale deprived consumers, and particularly plaintiff, of the ability to get a fair market read on the market for the goods he purchased, the shirts, by taking away his practical ability to comparison shop. We also allege that as a result,
I can't understand what you mean by that, his impractical ability to comparison shop. He can look at the shirts, and if three of them aren't worth whatever it is, $89, he goes to another store and looks at the prices there.
Well, the issue is that if going to another store requires another trip, by the time he goes to the other store, and if he finds out that they're on sale for $96, he's been told by Bank that his ability to get them for $89 is over.
But you said they've got these continuous sales, sale after sale.
Well, he didn't know it at the time. That's the problem.
Yeah, but I don't understand in the world today why he couldn't go to Joseph Bank in the morning and get to another store the same day. They're not going to pull the sale the same day.
Well, I mean, I think that any time you've got this time pressure, it's a problem. And I mean,
so no sales can have deadlines. All the sales have to have kind of an open end. The Ford will be $3,000 off.
No, I think that sales, true sales, absolutely have deadlines, and that's what Mr. Camasta expected.
Well, and then when this chart that you provided to us showed deadlines, because in the chart you showed us, the store ran different sales at different times. Sometimes the suits were on sale. They weren't on sale all the time. Sometimes the shirts were on sale. Sometimes items were 40% off. Some were 60% off. So doesn't that strongly suggest that different items were sold for different prices at different times?
Well, and here's where we run into the problem of what posture we're in. The chart we provided was what we were able to cull together based on publicly available source material,
right, and
without
what I'm saying,
benefit of discovery.
Yeah, and I'm saying, let's assume this that you pulled together is totally accurate. It hurts you. It defeats you because it shows shirts were not continually on sale. It shows that different items were on sale for limited periods. And so that's a problem.
Well, but what I guess what I'm saying is I don't think that the sales listed in our chart is anywhere close to exhaustive. I think that
it doesn't need to be exhaustive because you defeat yourself with what it is as what you gave us.
Well, I mean, what we have pled and what our theory is that the shirts were continuously on sale, and the fact that we were only able to find evidence here and evidence there from what we were able to find without discovery, I think is neither here nor there. In retrospect, should we have not taken that exercise and just stood on the bare allegations? Perhaps. But that, I guess, gets me into my next point, which is that this is a circumstance where the goalposts moved, so we really never did have a chance to correct deficiencies.
Well, why didn't you file why didn't you ask for leave to amend a second time to resolve the? I mean, you knew where the court was coming from with respect to the standard that was being applied, and because the court was applying the 9B standard, so why didn't you ask for a second chance to amend?
Well, I think that we did. Certainly, I would ask
you
for that now.
To amend?
No, well, we opposed the motion to dismiss. We believe our complaint is sufficient, but what the outcome, the decision was a dismissal without prejudice for a completely new reason than the first dismissal.
But and you agreed that you had as an option to file a motion to leave to amend.
In opposition to the motion to dismiss prior to the judge's ruling, yes.
Right, and then after the judge's ruling, you could have asked the court to reconsider and move to amend then.
We could have done so.
And you didn't do that to try to correct the deficiencies, because clearly the court wasn't buying your argument about which standard applied.
And frankly, I think the court was wrong in that, and we made the decision to take it up here, but I don't think that this court is precluded from sending it back down with instructions to allow us to replead.
But how would you replead it so
we would take away this chart if it's being read as an allegation that these are all the sales that there are. The allegation is that the items are continuously on sale such that the retail price was, as this course said in Kim's, something made up. And that is the gravamen of the cause of action. That is what I think we pled sufficiently. And to the extent that the chart is the problem, we would plead it without the chart. And with respect to the...
You know, let's get back to these shirts for a minute. The district court found that you didn't sufficiently allege that your client paid more than the actual value for the property. So in an amendment, are you saying you'd be able to show that?
I think so. I mean, I think that we did sufficiently plead that, but if...
But with no backup.
Well, right.
That's
mean,
the problem.
Well,
no backup.
And
so when you
part of the problem is that there hasn't really been standards established for what needs to be pled in this type of cause of action. Court said that the cause of action exists, but hasn't really said. I mean, it might be like a MedMal case where you need an expert report in order to plead it. I don't think it should be that way. I don't, and obviously this court's going to tell us, but if that's the case, yeah, we get an expert, a market expert who would do an analysis of what Mr. Kamaskis could have bought these shirts for if Joseph A. Bank hadn't been in the market
well,
with this.
The district court never suggested that you needed expert testimony. You needed some comparison, and so that just requires your client to walk or drive to other stores to get the price comparison on the shirts.
Well,
you agree that that's something that could be done.
I think that's true.
And was not done.
I think
because the fact that he just makes the bare statement that he would get a cheaper price, well, it's just not enough.
Okay. Well, and I think that and that gets us back to the time pressure issue. And obviously, Mr. Kamasta, had he had this to do over again, would go around and check other prices. And he wouldn't trust the fact that he's got this deadline. And as a practical matter, yeah, I mean, we could spend an entire day comparison shopping for shirts. But
So it's not the quality of the product, it's the pricing that is fraudulent?
The pricing is fraudulent. That's correct, Your Honor. And I, if I could just talk a little bit about the second cause of action, because I think that that is the one with broader implication. I know, Your Honor, and that's why I want to get there just a little bit. And that is that what the ruling was on the essentially 23B2 cause of action, class cause of action for an injunction to stop the unfair practice. The ruling is that essentially once somebody finds out that this practice exists, they no longer have standing to sue about it. And we maintain that can't be the law. Thank you, Your Honors. I reserve the balance.
Mr. Walter.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to begin by talking about the factual pleading requirements that the amended complaint failed to satisfy, and I would also like the opportunity to talk about why the amended complaint did not sufficiently plead facts showing the actual damages. But I'll begin by addressing some of the issues that were discussed just previously, the first being this issue of leave to amend. Joseph A. Bank agrees with the comments that at the point that the court rendered judgment of dismissal with prejudice, Mr. Camasso was put to the test. He can either say, my petition is sufficient, and I believe the judge is wrong, I'm going to ask the Seventh Circuit to reverse, or he can ask the court to reopen, ask for leave to amend the complaint, and attach to that motion a proposed complaint. Then the district court would have an opportunity to rule upon that issue. And if it was denied, then there'd be a proper point of appeal, perhaps. But that didn't happen here. He decided his complaint was sufficient, so he should not be granted leave to go back and replead the complaint. Mr. Oppenheim suggested that if he were to replead, what he might do is remove the chart that showed the sales that he contends were a part of this pattern and practice of fraudulent activity. As the district court made clear, the problem is not too many facts. The problem is too few facts. And there are two standards. One is the Rule 9B. Under Rule 9B, he had to plead his claims with fraud because, as this court said in its decision in Pirelli, it's the fraud allegations, not necessarily characterizing a claim as fraud, that triggers the requirement to plead with particularity. And here, there was not a pleading of particularity about even the advertisement itself. The core of any fraud is the representation. We don't know what that representation is, and so it's difficult to calculate what the problem is and how Mr. Camasta claims he was deceived. Mr. Oppenheim suggested that Rule 9B was a brand new reason that the case was dismissed, the second go-round in respect to his amended complaint. But in the court's dismissal of the original complaint, the February 2013 order, the judge talked about Rule 9B. She did analysis, and she found that the heightened pleading standard did apply. And while she didn't expressly state that she was dismissing on that basis, she said in a footnote, the outcome would have been the same under Rule 8A, even if she didn't find that Rule 9B applied. And there's at least an implication that she was finding that this complaint was insufficient on that basis. Mr. Camasta understood that. In resisting the motion to dismiss the amended complaint, he stated in his memorandum in opposition, I've complied with Rule 9B. I've stated the who, what, when, where, and how. This is in his conclusion. And so he can't really say this was a new and surprising reason that the case was dismissed with respect to the amended complaint. Throughout the amended complaint and throughout the briefs, Mr. Camasta relies upon conclusory assertions that don't comply with the requirements of Rule 8A and the Supreme Court's interpretations in Twombly and Ashcroft. He talked about the New York case, for example, that there was a settlement a decade ago in New York with the Attorney General. And he states that the sales that happened a decade ago in New York are identical to the sales that were going on in Illinois in 2009 and 2012. There are no facts that show that. The assurance of discontinuance that Joseph A. Bank entered into in New York has a list of sales. The amended complaint has a list of sales. If you look at the sales themselves, they aren't even the same. They're very different. And the whole conclusion is not even plausible. Because in that assurance of discontinuance, Joseph A. Bank agreed at the end not only to pay a penalty, but to devise new policies and procedures that would comply with the assurance, comply with New York law, which is based on the Federal Trade Commission's Guides Against Deceptive Practices, which is something that's been compared to the ICFA. And they also agreed to provide corroboration that they had complied. So it's illogical to suggest that they would have agreed to pay this penalty and devise these new procedures and to confirm it with the Attorney General of New York, and then they changed nothing, kept using the same practices.
Yeah, because give me the timing of that, when that was signed, when they agreed to that.
That was September of 2004, and it concerned an analysis of practices in 2003 and 2004.
And we're talking now about 2012.
Correct. Yeah, the class period runs back to 2009. And the list of sales is a two-year period preceding the filing in August of 2012. Mr. Oppenheim expresses concern that this ruling might foreclose these types of claims or require a plaintiff to bring an expert witness in pre-litigation to make the analysis, but this court's comments are right on the mark. All it requires is shopping around, and that's what this court wrote in the Kim v. Carr's decision. They said you have to make allegations that you could have shopped around and obtained a better price in the marketplace. And what Mr. Camasta did in his amended complaint is he just literally rewrote those words in his complaint. He just recited them and thought that that would be enough. If that was enough, any consumer could sue any retailer or in any advertisement and say, I was deceived, no facts to support that. I could have bought somewhere else for less with no facts to support that and survive dismissal. And that cannot be where the bar is. Instead, as you suggested, there should be some due diligence, especially before you bring a class action lawsuit alleging fraud against someone. You should have to spend a day shopping around. Go to Men's Warehouse. Go to Brooks Brothers. Look at comparable shirts to the ones you chose to purchase with the same features, wrinkle-free, button-down collar, 100% cotton, and look at the pricing. And if the price that was available at Joseph A. Bank was lower than anywhere else in the marketplace, you cannot have been damaged. That's what Kim v. Carter said. That's the same thinking in the Mulligan case. If there aren't any other questions on that topic, I'd like to talk briefly about the injunction issue. In the original brief, Mr. Camasta suggested that this ruling and the arguments Joseph A. Bank had put forward would foreclose these types of injunctive relief being available as a public policy basis. That shouldn't be the way it is. It is the way it is. This IUDTPA statute, primarily its purpose is to avoid unfair competition. It's not to provide consumers with the ability to get injunctive relief. And courts, numerous courts have held, if you have that awareness, if you know that you think that they use deceptive practices, avoid them. Don't shop at Joseph A. Bank. Shop somewhere else. And the Robinson Court in 2000 at the state level, they said that's one of the problems with bringing these types of claims. Usually the plaintiff knows about it and is foreclosed from having the ability to bring the claim. And nowhere does Mr. Camasta even address the Article 3 issue. The Supreme Court says you have to have a real and immediate threat of future harm before you can even seek an injunction. If the court has no other questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Oppenheim have? How much? You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. The issue here is the ongoing practice and what the corporate headquarters is. The allegation is that there is a conscious decision to make up fictitious retail prices and then offer sales as what the real retail price is. That is the thing that this court said in Kim's.
Yep, and that's the thing you don't have, because you don't have any evidence of that. You didn't present anything in the complaint to support that allegation.
In Kim's, we're at the summary judgment level, and it may be that after discovery, there won't be anything there. But I'm not...
That's what the higher fraud pleading requirements require. And they... you have to have more there at this point.
I mean, I think we do. I think that the New York evidence, I mean, that's
what about
an exhibit. That's part of the.
What happened in 2004, the New York settlement?
And it didn't.
And the purchase was.
And it didn't stop.
In 2012.
It's
yeah,
the
but
same
you didn't put
practice.
Any. Yeah, you didn't have. You don't have any evidence of that.
And it's not an admission of liability on their part. It's an agreed resolution of accusations. It's not a finding of wrongdoing.
Well, there's an order. There's an order. I think it's entitled to full faith and credit. But the point is that we have put forward. This is what happened here. It's sufficiently similar, I think, to what they were cited for then. And it's similar to the examples that we found that we pled that we've included with our allegations. And I think that has to be enough to get past the pleading stage because you're never going to have more than what is publicly available vis-a-vis what the internal practices and procedures of the defendant are. I mean, there are countless 9B cases on that, too, that if the missing piece is something that is wholly in the possession of the defendant, that you're allowed to get into discovery and get at it. And I think that's what's necessary here. With regard to the injunction point, that this isn't a circumstance where anybody can bring a claim based on anything. It's a circumstance where there's a past harm, there's an ongoing practice, and it's a statute that has been held, contrary to what counsel maintained, to be applicable for use by consumers just as well as competitive businesses.
And going back to the first area, you know, whether you pled sufficiently, I mean, you didn't even specify in the complaint what the ad said.
The ad said buy one, get two
free. In the particulars. And or how he learned that the sale wasn't a temporary price reduction.
In with respect, I don't see how you figured out that you've been had is the element of a fraud claim is a necessary pleading element. The issue is that he'd been had.
We understand your argument.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement.